You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works volume, 314 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Physiology and Healing, translated by Anna Moyse. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on the 9th of October, 1920. It will, of course, only be possible to speak in general terms about specific methods of treatment, particularly as the time available for this therapeutic part of our conference is short. On the other hand, it is also a somewhat doubtful thing to have to give details on specific subjects, particularly in medicine, unless one has an audience wholly of professionals in this field, as was the case in the spring. On the one hand, it will be necessary in future human evolution for as many people as possible to come to understand the general principles of healing, the consequences of medicine, as it were, so that there can be a relationship of trust between physician and patient, based, however, on proper knowledge of the subject. Yet, although there is need to have such understanding on the broadest possible basis, in order to have social hygiene, it is, on the other hand, not desirable that too many amateurish lay opinions are given room in medicine, though this has been very much the case in more recent times. The system of medicine being what it is, it really must be stressed that it cannot in the least be my intention to encourage any form of quackery, and that in our spiritual science, with anthroposophical orientation, there certainly must be the endeavor to support genuine medical knowledge based on exact methodical study, the art of medicine, and to bring spiritual scientific insights into this genuine art of medicine. So we do not wish to be in the ranks of people who, out of an infinite ignorance concerning the subject they are talking about, declare themselves up in arms against all kinds of things they label conventional medicine and the like. No, we certainly do not wish to be counted among them. Something else must also be taken into account when we discuss things of this kind. Something has entered into medicine in more recent times. In a sense, it has been there for a long time, but it has made itself felt more recently with all the vehemence generally found in a social order seemingly as chaotic as ours. It is the tendency to form factions even within the medical community. And these factions are as aggressive toward one another as our political parties, I'd say. This cannot be helpful for medicine, as is only too evident quite generally. The fight of allopaths with homeopaths, conventional, in quotes, medical professionals with those versed in natural medicine, and so forth, has brought much confusion into the understanding of medicine, which we need to have among wider sections of the community. This had to be said first, so that the things I will be saying today may not be given the wrong basis. I spoke to you of how, on the one hand, we have the element of spirit and soul in the human organizing process, and how it hypertrophies, as it were, when physical diseases develop, so that this element of mind or spirit and soul does not stand apart from the physical organ in the right way, and therefore proliferates within it. Here, we are dealing with all the diseases that go in the direction of neoplasms in the organism. On the other hand, we have diseases where the element of mind and soul develops in such a way that it does not adequately intervene in the physical organism, and therefore leaves certain parts of the physical organism to processes that have not been taken up by the human organization, but left to the subordinate processes of natural existence. I'd say, so that organs become physicalized, if I may use the word, to an overwhelming degree, instead of filling themselves with qualities of soul and spirit. The element of soul and spirit then flows out and cannot be properly spanned by self-awareness, the conscious I, with the result that conditions, rather incorrectly called mental diseases, develop. This view has to be modified, however. It has to be given a more precise form, I'd say, as soon as we move from sound physiology to sound pathology and therapy. It needs to come together with the view of the essential human being, which has been presented here on repeated occasions, though in a very different context than the one we need today. It is the view of the human organism in its threefold nature. On the one hand, human beings are threefold in their soul, in forming ideas, in feeling, and in their will impulses. But this threefold nature of the soul exactly corresponds with a threefold physical body, with a kind of head or neurosensory system, a rhythmic system, and a system of metabolism and limbs. Let me stress that this differentiation of the human organism must not be considered with the intellect, but as a particular view. Someone who would consider the head system to be the part that extends down to the neck, and then the circulatory or rhythmic system is the part that comprises the trunk, and then the system of digestion and limbs, including the sexual system, making such an external differentiation, would not have the right idea. The point is that the neurosensory system is located mainly in the head, but also extends through all the rest of the organism. In a sense, therefore, we have to say, when referring to the neurosensory system in anthroposophical terms, that it is the system of functions in the human organism, for we are dealing not with boundaries in space, but boundaries between functions, which is mainly located in the head, but extends head activity through the whole human being. So that in a way the whole human being would also be, in quotes, head. It is the same for the other systems. And it was plain mischief when an irresponsible professor of medicine, who had no intention to consider things properly, but did want to cast aspersions on these things in the eyes of the world, spoke of the, in quotes, belly system, to discredit what is really meant by metabolic system. He showed that he failed to realize that with such a differentiation, it is the functional aspect which counts, and not boundaries that might be set in space. Once you have grasped this differentiation, and one could give many lectures to describe every detail, you clearly understand the differences between the head system, that is, the neurosensory system on the one hand, the system of metabolism and limbs on the other, and the middle system, the rhythmic system, which essentially serves to maintain the balance between the other two systems. If we then want to encompass the whole of essential human nature, we have the following. The actual idea forming and sensory activity has everything which physically happens in the neurosensory system for its basis. We can't actually say instrument, but its basis. The view held in more recent psychology and physiology that the processes which are primarily connected with the system of feeling and of will take place in the neurosensory system is not correct. It will not stand up to a more detailed study of the subject. You will find an indication of this more detailed study, or at least its guiding principles, in my book, German title, Von Seelenrätseln, parenthesis, extracts in title, The Case for Anthroposophy, close parenthesis. Much detailed work still needs to be done in this direction. Then the things which can today be said with certainty on the basis of spiritual science will also be evident from the other point of view, the physical and empirical point of view. It will be evident that human feeling is not primarily connected with the neurosensory system, but with the rhythmic system. Where the neurosensory system relates to sensory perception and the forming of ideas, the rhythmic system relates to feeling. It is only because the rhythmic system interacts with the neurosensory system via the rhythm of our cerebrospinal fluid, a rhythm that comes up against the neurosensory system, that this system is made the vehicle for our life in ideas when we raise our feelings to ideas. Our dim, dreamlike life and feelings is then perceived by us and becomes inner idea. Just as life and feeling is directly connected with the rhythmic system and is indirectly mediated by it, so does the life in will connect directly with the metabolic system. This connection is then such that secondarily, for there is metabolism also in the brain, the functions of the metabolic system come up against the neurosensory system, and we thus inwardly manage to produce ideas of our will impulses, impulses which otherwise would play in a dim life of sleep in our organism. You see that we have three different systems in the human organism, and each sustains the life of the psyche in a different way. These systems not only differ from one another, but they are also opposites. As I said, I can only refer to these things briefly today. We thus have the neurosensory system on the one hand, and on the other, everything that makes up the functions of the metabolic system, the system of metabolism and limbs, see Plate 3. You can, of course, develop ideas about the connection between metabolism and limbs by simply considering the influence which limbs in motion have on metabolism. This influence is much greater than people tend to think. But I'd say that these two systems, neurosensory system and system of metabolism and limbs, are in a way also polar opposites. This opposition must be thoroughly considered in order to develop a sound pathology and therapy, especially a pathology that develops in a wholly organic way into therapy, thoroughly studying every single detail, and the details are, of course, countless. The following emerges when we consider the detailed influences. Something to which I referred briefly yesterday then becomes evident. It is that this thing I referred to yesterday is present to a high degree. Processes of degradation exist within everything connected with the head system, the neurosensory system. When we form ideas in our waking state, making sensory perceptions and forming ideas, this is not bound up with the processes of growth and development, but with processes of degradation, of elimination. You will, in fact, arrive at this by looking, in a sound way, at the things which empirical physiological science has to offer today. Empirical proof is available today, or I might put it better, by saying empirical proof of knowledge gained by contemplation in spiritual science. Study the things certain inspired physiologists are able to say about physical processes in the nervous system that run parallel to the forming of ideas and to sensory perception. You will see that the statement that we are dealing with processes of elimination and degradation, catabolism, and not of anabolism, when we are awake and thinking, perceiving things, is very well substantiated today. We have anabolic processes, however, where processes of will come to realization in the system of metabolism and limbs. All the individual functions of the human being are, of course, interactive. Looking at this in the right way, we have to say that the anabolic processes act from below upward into the catabolic processes, and the catabolic process down from above into the anabolic processes. Study the matter in these terms, and you'll then have the rhythmic process maintaining the balance between catabolic and anabolic processes. Its functions drive catabolism and anabolism into catabolism. If we study this in the right way, not just outwardly, to see what is going on in the circulation of the blood, as it is called, of the heart, as the human body is breathed through, you have everywhere in there special processes that are interrupted in some way, as I might put it. I can't go into this interruption, for good reason, but the curve of this rhythm, which I have drawn here, plate 3, right, is everywhere specialized. The breathing process is a special case of this curve. And if you draw the movement of blood from the heart upward to the head, or else to the lung and down into the body, these are special cases of this process. In short, if you bring life into the things which I am just touching on here, you enter into the tissue of functions in the human organism, not in the usual, rather dead way, but in a living way. You must, however, make your ideas themselves come to life. You'll need to visualize a three-dimensional image of the human organism in a way. You cannot encompass the human organism with the static, abstract ideas people want to have in modern physiology and pathology. We have to grasp it in ideas that move, ideas that truly enter into the action of something that is inwardly mobile, and certainly not mere mechanical interactions among organs that are at rest. We thus begin to see that essentially there is constant interaction in the human organism between catabolic processes, killing processes, and the anabolic processes of growth, processes of proliferation, and so on. We cannot comprehend the human organism unless we proceed in this way. But what do we really have there? Take a closer look. When the destructive catabolic process of the neurosensory organization acts through rhythm into the system of metabolism and limbs, we have something which acts against the system of metabolism and limbs, is poison to it. Conversely, when the principle in the constructive anabolic system acts through rhythm into the head system, it is poison to the head system. As I said, the systems spread through all the rest of the organism, and so we have constant poisoning and detoxification everywhere in the human organism, with the rhythmic process balancing them out. We are not looking into a natural process of the kind one would generally like to have, a process going in a particular direction, easily understood direction, I'd like to say, so that we may simply refer to the healthy processes as normal. No, we are looking into two processes acting in opposite directions, with the one definitely harmful to the other, and we actually cannot live in our physical organism without our system of limbs and metabolism continually exposed to the causes of sickness from the head system, and the head system to the causes of sickness from the metabolic system. Just as scales that are not balanced go to one side, wholly according to natural laws, with the beam not in the horizontal, the state of balance that exists in life is unstable, not static, and they go in the one direction or the other, leading to irregularity. To cure is simply that when the actions of a head system are too toxic for the metabolic system, you relieve the head of its toxic action, taking it away. Or conversely, if the actions of the system of limbs and metabolism are too toxic for the head system, causing proliferation, the former must be relieved of its toxic action. Our view of this area will only be complete, however, when we are in a position to extend anything observed in the human being to the whole of nature, and are able to see that nature, from the spiritual scientific point of view, from the spiritual scientific point of view. Looking at the way a plant develops, for instance, you very clearly see, in the most macroscopic way, a plant development process that strives upward, seeks to move away from the earth's center. It is most interesting to study these metamorphosing endeavors to develop in Goethe's title Metamorphosis of Plants, at least for the first basic principles. Goethe's Metamorphosis of Plants outlines the very first classification, the very first elements of plant nature to be studied in this way. The method needs to be further developed. The basic principles must be followed, and this will give us a living way of seeing everything that happens when plants grow. The plant roots in the soil, developing the negative of upward striving, as it were, in the root. It then grows upward, overcoming earth's powers of attraction that are still highly active in the root. It battles its way through other forces and finally comes into flower, developing fruit and seed. Many things happen along that road. One is that an opposing force comes in again. You can observe this opposing force. Taking some example, for instance, take common birch, let us say silver birch, Betula alba, and look more closely at the process that goes from development of the root to the trunk, and there especially the bark, and then on the basis of everything that is involved in trunk and bark development, we get leaf development. We can study this particularly well in the spiritual scientific way by studying the young birch leaves when they are still brownish in spring. Studying all this, we gain a view of how the forces involved metamorphose, forces that are active in the inner plant. And we see how, on the one hand, the direction of forces in plant development is from below upward. And we also have the element which still causes retardation, which in the root, I'd say, still acted strongly as gravity. But then, as the plant struggles free of earth's substance, forces act from the air, working together with the upward striving force in a different way. Then comes an interesting stage, though again wholly factual, to realize how in this upward striving process in birch bark, certain salts are deposited in the bark as the plant develops, potassium salts. These are simply the outcome of the downward acting forces in their interaction with the upward acting forces and tend toward protein production. I'd say to something I would like to call the development of albuminizing powers. And so one penetrates the plant development process, for instance. I can only refer to it briefly here. You see, we penetrate into it by looking, as it were, how potassium salts are deposited in birch bark, how something then struggles free from this power that draws things down. I'd say a kind of process roughly comparable to a salt precipitating from a solution. And we come to the process which consists in the solution coming free of the salt. If we grasp this in a living way, we come to the protein-producing process, into something I'd like to call the albuminizing process. This is a way of studying with vision the outside world around the human being. We then return to the human being and consider the catabolic process, which acts from above downward. We see that basically, let us say, human beings have the kind of forces in them which in plants act from below upward. Looking at the forces that act down from the head system toward the system of limbs and metabolism, we are, as it were, seeing the forces acting downward, which in plant development were being sent up from below. If someone blocks this plant development active in him, doing so in the wrong way, so that the process is not coming from the sphere of head activity, the astral I nature, capital I, to penetrate bodily nature in the right way, and the penetration comes to expression within the living body, we have something which is blocked, though it should take its course in the human organism. This is a pathological phenomenon which we see, for instance, when rheumatic disease or gout develops. Looking from the inner organism, let us say, to a process in plant development like the one we found in silver birch, we learn the following. On the one hand, we are considering what happens when salts form, and on the other, when protein forms. If we understand the process of protein synthesis properly, we find in there a process which is the opposite to the situation where something is blocked. The process is held up in the organism, which should run in a way similar to the process which runs properly as albuminization in birch leaves. We thus see a connection between the processes found in birch leaves, for instance, and the processes in the organism. If we use the principle found in birch leaves to produce medicines, which we give to people, these will be therapeutic because they are correctly counteracting this blocking process which leads to rheumatic disease and gout. We are seeing both what is happening outside in the natural world and what is happening in the inner organism. This gives us an idea as to how we should direct the healing powers. On the other hand, when catabolic processes proceed in a way where the organism is, as it were, unable to stop them, they broaden out in a downward direction. The rhythmic system is not sending them back in the right way. And they go to the periphery of the body, forcing their way outward to the skin, as it were. This results in inflammatory changes in the outside part of the human being, skin eruptions and the like. Looking at our plant Betula alba, again we find the opposite process, with potassium salts deposited in the bark, and are able to see how to combat this skin eruption process, which in human beings leads to hyperexudation, by making a birch bark medicine. We are thus able to study the actions of vegetable and mineral processes and see a connection between activities in outside nature and in the human being. In other words, we see medical empiricism, therapeutic empiricism, raised to the level which Goethe, in his terms, now not intellectual, called the rational stage of science. We gain a science for therapy, where the connections are truly understood. Things are not too easy, for we really have to study things in detail, at least according to certain types. In the first place, the hidden types of individual human nature and the secrets of existence in the natural world. Nor should you think that once you have studied the process in an example such as Betula alba, you have fully grasped all that matters. These developmental processes are of a very different kind with some other plant development processes, in horse chestnut or the like. The things I have touched on here must not lead to general drivel and twaddle, but to very serious and extensive study. But, and here I would particularly address the ladies and gentlemen who are students, done in a rational way, this kind of study should not, if done rightly, make you afraid of its vast extent. I can assure you that when all the ballast of examinations, examination Tartarus to use Periclesian terms, is eliminated, and instead you do everything which in this way leads to a rational view of therapeutic pathology and pathological therapy, medical students will not need to study more, but indeed less. And being full of life, this study will evoke greater enthusiasm in you than the things taught today concerning the human being, which essentially give you nothing but organs which are definitely not at rest and can only be understood if you grasp their living function and their interaction with other organs as you study this organization, if you grasp the way this goes wholly into the functional sphere. And you will also have a science of the natural world outside, which likewise takes you to the functional aspects. It will always be necessary, again and again, to study the inner process in the human being, the particular processes of poisoning and toxic effects that are no longer in balance, side by side with processes which do not follow the natural order, and the external being the polar opposite to the internal, must in a way also be used in polar opposite ways, and thus may certainly lead to pathology, or to use a better term, to therapeutic pathology and pathological therapy. I have only been able to touch briefly on the road to be taken to make the study of medicine sound, and I was only able to hint at the way in which the science of the spirit needs to be brought into this study of medicine. This evening, when I'll again speak for half an hour after the eurythmy performance, I'll give you some further examples which will show how such intuitive vision of activities, both in the natural world outside and in the inner organism, can lead to the therapeutic aspect and to insight into the pathological element. I'd wish to go into individual substances then. In the short time available to me, I've only been able to demonstrate the principle on the example of Betula Alba. Tonight I will go further, but will always make sure to speak of things meant for general human understanding. Medical professionals will have to build on this basis. They need to consider the specific, for to treat the specific in this way also calls for individual assessment, and it will be necessary for all lay people to understand the medical principles so that understanding, a sympathy, develops for the things which the medical profession have to undertake in the world outside. If you consider the line which we want to follow in spiritual science with anthroposophical orientation for the field of medicine, I'll have more to say on this tonight. You are bound to say to yourselves, truly, in this spiritual science with anthroposophical orientation, the aim is not to go for charlatanism, lay approaches, and amateurism. The aim is above all to help science, genuine, serious science, to grow sound. And this will in itself, no doubt, have social consequences. The end of Lecture 3.